also doing a few international conferences to talk about what dementia care needs to look like worldwide. So a decade working in long-term care communities all across the United States, from Kentucky to Washington State, I've moved a lot and worked in 15 different care communities in the last decade. So that's kind of my background. I'd love to hear about yours.
That's amazing. I actually spent close to 10 years in North Carolina. I was in Durham. So I did a lot of my training in the VA system and in Durham at Duke. And then I moved here maybe 2013. And my primary clinical practice is actually in long-term care. So I see.
According to the Ontario Dementia Care Alliance, in Ontario, Canada alone, there are more than 330,000 people living with dementia today. That number is expected to triple in the next 30 years to be around 1 million people. When we focus on the numbers and medical terms, it's easy to lose sight of the people experiencing these changes in their cognition and communication. Dementia is one of the top three conditions supported in long-term care in Ontario, which is part of the publicly funded healthcare system that provides 24/7 nursing support to people whose care needs can't be met safely at home. In this episode, we are reimagining dementia care and long-term care and looking at the necessary partnership between clinical insight and compassionate communication that guide care teams across Ontario's homes every day. Dr. Sophia Benjamin is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurosciences at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. She also holds the Schlegel Chair for Mental Health and Aging. Sophia is the co-founder and co-executive director of Jerry MedRisk, a publicly funded, not-for-profit organization that optimizes medication use in older adults through clinical consultations across Ontario and the education of clinicians both nationally and internationally. Adria Thompson is a licensed speech-language pathologist, faculty member at Eastern Kentucky University, a TEDx speaker, and founder of Be Light Care, which is the largest dementia care education platform on social media, reaching more than 600,000 caregivers and professionals worldwide. Most recently, Adria was awarded a grant to develop a micro-learning platform for caregivers and professionals. The Dementia Care app will launch this year. As the rate of dementia continues to rise in Ontario, the challenge before us isn't only medical, but also cultural. Reimagining dementia care and long-term care isn't about people with dementia. It's about honoring the person first, period. Let's dive in. I am just really delighted today to be joined by two remarkable women who are leaders in research, but also thinking about the application of their research and providing services and supports to those who are having to deal with dementia. Today's theme really is around dementia care and supports, but I'm wondering if we could just start off so that our audience has a common understanding about what we're talking about when we refer to dementia. And that's such a heavy word. It's full of stigma. It incites fear. And people are afraid of the word itself, let alone the diagnosis. So I don't know, Adria, do you want to start us off with maybe that initial level set? And Sophia, would love your perspective on how you frame this as well, as we talk about it and educate people about what is dementia.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us, Donna. So dementia is a neurodegenerative disease, which means neuro meaning that it's something that's going on in the brain, and degenerative meaning that it gets worse over time. And so dementia is essentially an umbrella term that refers to conditions that do two main things. Number one, it causes changes in a person's ability to think. That can include memory, problem solving, reasoning, judgment. It can also impact language. So our thinking abilities, what our brain is so good at doing. So The one component is having that change in thinking and difficulty with cognitive processes. And then the other component is that dementia causes difficulty for a person to go about their normal life, to care for themselves, to engage in their daily activities. And so dementia is not a normal part of aging. Normal changes that can happen with your brain and your memory and thinking over time as you get older does not impact your daily life and does not impact your ability to care for yourself. And so that is why it's so important to us to understand that dementia is something that is not normal, and it's certainly something that needs to be assessed if you're starting to experience those cognitive changes that are affecting your life. That is the most simplistic, probably, definition of dementia, and I'm sure Sophia can kind of dive into that a little bit more.
Adria, I think you broke it down perfectly, that there is a change in cognition, and that can be a number of different domains, because when people think about dementia, automatically they think it's a memory disorder. You might even find clinics called memory clinics, but there are so many other aspects of the way our brain functions in our day-to-day basis. So social cognition, knowing what to say where, when, and how. You mentioned language, executive functioning, putting information together in a logical way. So all of these are important cognitive functions, and someone could have preserved memory, but have real difficulties with processing their environment visuospatially, and they could have a different type of dementia. So you described it really well when you said it's an umbrella term that captures many different disorders. And the key really here is function, that one is not able to do the things that they were able to do before. And that change is not due to a physical impairment. So if someone was able to do groceries and now they can't walk, and they can't do groceries now because of their ability to walk or their mobility, that's not the functional loss that we're talking about. This is someone was able to do their groceries before. Now they're having a hard time keeping the list intact. They're having a hard time navigating, finding their way there. So that type of functional loss. And another aspect that I sometimes come across is individuals who, and these may relate only to special subpopulations, that people lose skills that they were once able to do. And that looks different for different folks. So someone who is, I don't know, a professor in mathematics is now not able to problem solve certain problems that would be a loss for them. But at the same time, I also see individuals who may have developmental delay, and they are starting from a different baseline, and they can have a different type of decline.
Such an important point, that individuals may present differently. We have in our heads these stereotypes, and our listeners have heard me talk about my own personal experience with my father living with Alzheimer's and supporting him. And I'd also been a respite volunteer for the Alzheimer's Society for a number of families. And each case was different. Each situation was different. And I had been studying in Nova Scotia when I was doing my volunteer work. And then I went home and I noticed my father's behaviors had changed. So he had become very withdrawn. He had always been very socially active with his friends. He had stopped being active with his friends. He had been very quiet. His personal hygiene had started to shift. And I have to tell you, it took us about 2 years to actually get people to agree with us that there was something wrong with my father. And so just even trying to get, as a caregiver, trying to get that attention, because others did not see the changes, they didn't see the difference, and his behaviors weren't what they likened to a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. So he wasn't getting lost, he wasn't wandering yet, he wasn't forgetting yet. So even those early stages, just trying to know what's normal and what's not normal, it really is a challenge, given the diversity of how dementia presents. Adria, your wonderful platform really is geared to educating caregivers. As family members, we're afraid. Sometimes we don't want to ask. We don't want to get a diagnosis. We don't want to go to the doctor because we don't want our fears to be validated. And yet those early interventions can really make a big difference.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what you and Sophia are describing is so true. It's uncharacteristic changes, right? Like they might not fit textbook definitions when you Google dementia, some of the symptoms that you're seeing in someone you love, because what you're going to see are repetitive questions, misplacing objects. And a lot of times we might read those descriptions and think, oh, well, they're not doing that. They're doing a ton of other weird things, but they're not doing that. So it can be a little misleading sometimes. And I think considering changes that are different from how they used to be is so important, that uncharacteristic change. I remember a caregiver once told me that the first thing that she remembers looking back that kind of raised a red flag for her before her mom got a diagnosis of frontotemporal dementia is that they were at a restaurant, and when they went to leave, she took the salt and pepper shakers and put them in her purse. And it's like, you will never see that on any checklist that you Google, but it was an uncharacteristic change for her mom. Like, it's nothing she would have ever done before. And so it is those things that just makes you question. Something might not be right. And it's difficult to explain that to other people, even if it is a doctor, to say, I'm noticing these small changes, these strange behaviors that they're having. And it's a very difficult time for loved ones to try to wrap their mind around what could be happening, but then also to advocate for that person that there might actually be something diagnosable happening.
And Sophia, you find this as well?
Absolutely. And sometimes family members may point out to a big event, like mom traveled to Florida this year, and usually she's able to manage it perfectly. But this time I noticed that, and it all started in December, right? So they kind of pinpointed to that. But often when we explore further, then we do find that there have been changes, often like you described, for 2 or sometimes 3 years before a family might think, okay, really, there's something going on here that we need additional help with. The way I look at diagnosis, because it can be very scary to receive a diagnosis of dementia, but what is the purpose of a diagnosis, or even a test? What is the purpose of even getting a test or a diagnosis? It's important for two things. One is to inform treatment so that if you are able to get treatments that can slow the process down, then that's a helpful thing. But there are some types of dementia where there is no treatment, like frontotemporal dementia, where we don't have anything that can slow the progress significantly. But the other really important thing about receiving a diagnosis is to plan, to work with the family to anticipate what's coming next, and to really be able to engage with the individual during that period when they can have these conversations and express their wishes to their family. And so I think that's precious time, that even if we can't change the course in when it comes to memory or that type of outcome, the journey that they experience with their family could be different.
Well, and the diagnosis, some of our older family members and friends, when they go to the doctor and they're given the clock test, and then they become very resentful, actually. It's amazing just the reaction to your primary care provider saying, hey, you're a person of a certain age. I'm going to give you this test. And who's the Prime Minister of Canada? What day is it today? And draw a clock and here are 3 words. And I have to be honest, I'm terrible at the 3 words because I've been to a lot of doctor's appointments with older people and then it gets me worried. But no, I think it really is important from a planning perspective. And I know, Adria, as you think about how do you educate and support, and it's the planning for later, but it's also, I would argue, planning for today so that you can actually take advantage of those moments that you still have together and to live. It's about living and hope and embracing those moments and making memories as well so that it's not all doom and gloom. It really is about the opportunity to support living well.
When we talk about someone getting diagnosed with dementia, they are not dying from dementia. They are living with dementia. And I think that's really important because especially we talked about what is dementia. Just a quick clarification, there are many diagnoses that fall under that umbrella term. So we just quickly mentioned frontotemporal dementia. The most common that most people have heard of is Alzheimer's disease. There's also Lewy body dementia, vascular dementia. The list goes on and on. But for people living with Alzheimer's disease, from the time of a first symptom to the last day of their life can be 20 years on average. And so when we're talking about getting a diagnosis of dementia, unlike many other conditions, this is something that is going to be lived with for a long time. And I think that's often missed because of the stigma around dementia, that there is such an important aspect of this of planning, because we're going to still have plenty of time to spend with each other while dementia is existing within the person that we love. And so I have a friend named Rita who's living with young onset Alzheimer's disease. And I was just with her yesterday, and she was saying, talking about one day she knows that she might have to move into a care community, that there might need to be a shift in the way that she's being cared for. But she says, I want to be part of the conversation, and I know then I might not be able to, so we're talking about it now. And that is so important, not only to honor and give dignity to the person living with dementia, but also for the caregivers to hear from out of their mouth what the person with dementia wants, so that 10 years down the road, when some of these tough decisions have to be made, caregivers aren't wondering if it's reflecting really what that person wanted. They will have already had the conversations, and they will be able to kind of bring to life the kind of care that they wanted.
I do wonder, too, as we think about that, that the element of living with something, living with dementia. I'm wondering, Sophia, from your perspective, what other misconceptions are there? Because we do go directly to the end and we talk about dying as opposed to living.
Yeah. So I think one of the big misconceptions, and this may be even across systems, that when we think of dementia, we think of it in isolation. So we might have a dementia strategy or a dementia unit, but dementia doesn't exist in isolation. Dementia usually is a diagnosis in older adults that exists along with multiple other conditions. So one of which is dementia. So the person may have diabetes and they may have pain from arthritis, and they may also have depression, and they also have dementia. And consequently, they are also on multiple medications. So it's that multimorbidity that's what we see when we see an individual with dementia. We see the whole gamut of other conditions that are very closely interlinked and at different times play out in different ways. So that's one, I wouldn't say misconception. I think it's a way that we see it that where it's a bit more complex than just the dementia.
Well, and it's so interesting because, and Adria, you touched on this as well, we tend to hone in on that dementia diagnosis. So even though you may have COPD or end-stage renal failure or congestive heart failure or diabetes or all of these other diagnoses, we tend to focus on the dementia element. And it's quite interesting. We did, the Ontario Long-Term Care Association did some polling over the summer months and we surveyed 7,500 Ontarians about their expectations on aging, what kind of care they were going to get, their expectations of family members providing care. And there's still a lot of denial among baby boomers in terms of whether or not they will ever need any additional care and supports. There is sort of an implied bias that if I need care, essentially, the government will make sure that it's there for me. I don't want my family members to support me. So this comes back where both of you have spoken about planning and what does it mean from a caregiver perspective. But there's also this new shift that we're seeing where among younger baby boomers, one, sort of on an earlier podcast, we actually talked about medically assisted aid in dying, where if I'm going to get a dementia diagnosis, I'm going to avail myself of assisted suicide and just be by virtue of that diagnosis, not the other things that they necessarily have going on. And it's really troubling because you can live well. I know my father was very joyful and a very happy soul, including it in during end stage Alzheimer's, but he found joy in things and we found joy with him. And it was a privilege to support him and care for him. And he got wonderful care at home, but also when he ultimately moved into a care environment. But there is this sense of fear and denial still that we are trying to deal with. And we lose sight of the other parts of the human being. This is a very, and oftentimes very individual experience. There are commonalities, yes, but every one of us is different. And the brain is this remarkable thing we're still learning about. What are you seeing in terms of trends or considerations as we think about more person-centered care? Sophia, do you want to start?
Sure. So one of the most common reasons why I get consulted in long-term care is when an individual is having a behavior that others see to be challenging, right? But when we think of someone expressing a certain behavior, whether it is verbally or physically, I feel like there are so many layers to this. And when we think of applying a person-centered care lens to this, here's an individual who, before they ever had dementia, before they age, they have their very unique personality, how they responded to the world. So I always joke about, I'm not very good at accepting help. Like there was a time when my then husband and I, we were in Pittsburgh and I was walking up this hill and I insisted on carrying this big suitcase and I didn't have dementia, but I didn't want that help at that moment. And if I have a cognitive impairment and if I'm in long-term care, I may not be that very gracefully help accepting person and would want to try to open that bottle of juice multiple times before someone opens it for me, right? So I think the person's individual personality and their temperament has a huge role in how they may express themselves when they have dementia. Then we layer on the type of dementia that they have, where they may have visuospatial perceptual challenges, or they may have depth perceptual challenges. They may not see who's coming from which angle, where, and they may be responding because of those deficits related to dementia. We're not even talking about the memory challenges that we spoke about. Then layer on to that physical challenges that they may be experiencing. So I took care of this gentleman once who, and this was in a care facility where every afternoon he would get really upset and flip tables, just walking around and just really upset. But if you observed him really carefully, he liked to walk all morning and he had arthritis. And over the course of the day, his pain increased. And then he would start flipping tables because he had a lot of pain, but he didn't have the words to say, I have pain and I need a pain medication. So then there are these medical and physical comorbidities. So coming back to person-centered care, when we start layering all these different elements, you can see that it becomes like a complex game of chess. Like you're starting with a few initial moves, but the more you go into it, there are infinite possibility. So I would say person-centered care is really being curious about why is this person expressing this behavior or having this challenge at this moment in this environment? Because you put them in their home, they may not have the same behavior. You are in long-term care, they may have a behavior that's very specific to their experience there. And I think it's both challenging, but also rewarding, right? And there's no algorithm, there's no one size fits all when it comes to taking care of someone with dementia. So a lot of curiosity, a lot of trying something, seeing how it works, and being truly compassionate in that moment with them.
People are communicating. They're just communicating in different kinds of ways. So whether you're in your family home environment, whether you're in a retirement or a seniors living environment, or in a long-term care home, you're still communicating. And so I'm really curious from your perspective, like, what does that person-centered care look like? And I know just through your work, you're working with people in all sorts of living and care environments as well, and at different stages and phases of the evolution of dementia.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with Sophia more. Like, the complex layers that makes up any human will come out in care. And certainly when you're caring with someone with a cognitive impairment, because they're not able to advocate or clearly communicate what they're experiencing. A phrase that I would almost chant in my head when I was working in long-term care communities, I've worked with hundreds of people one-on-one, providing speech therapy services over a decade. And there are so many times where there would be a situation that made no sense to me. It seemed so odd. And there was no obvious explanation for the reason that they were behaving the way they were. And I would just chant to myself, everything they do makes sense to them. And if I truly could believe that, it kind of drove off that frustration that I started feeling welling up inside of me that, oh, this makes no sense. This is so random. This is so unreasonable, the way that they're acting. If I could just replace that believing that what they're doing makes sense to them, then it started allowing me to be a little bit more compassionate, but certainly more curious. And a really good example of this was a woman who, communication is a part of everything, right? So I would get referrals when some residents in our community would, this one lady, we'll call her Mary, she would say she had to go to the bathroom, she would agree to it, but then as soon as they would get her turned around and start to assist her to sit down on the toilet, she would stiffen up like a board, and she would fight, and she would get upset, and they were really trying, like, this was impacting her, their ability to care for her, her cleanliness, her hygiene, and over the course of several days doing this with her, taking her to the bathroom and seeing this for myself, I started really paying attention to her facial expressions because she wasn't very verbal. And I started noticing as we were approaching the toilet, she started having this like weird face. And one day she said, yuck. And it hit me. I thought, okay, everything she does makes sense to her. And so I, like, with my gloves on, I got a wet wipe. I showed her cleaning off the seat of the toilet. I said, okay, Mary, it's all clean. I turned her around. She sat right down. And it, for her, for whatever reason, she had a Parkinsonism, which could include some hallucinations of like seeing things on the toilet seat. But also maybe she was someone who just never fully made contact with a toilet seat in a public place. And she didn't realize that this apartment she was in was hers and that it was private and it was just used by her. And just implementing that small trick of cleaning the toilet seat every time that we took her to the bathroom, we could maybe document that as, oh, she increased compliance. She complied with care. But no, we just made it make sense for her. We realized that there was something that was being a barrier for her. And once we were curious enough and tried a million things, we found out that, okay, she thought it was dirty. And that's why she didn't want to sit down, but she just couldn't tell us. And there's, like, I'm sure Sophia and I can have a million examples like this of just being curious and present, observing them enough to kind of, some things we may never figure it out, but sometimes we can. And it can really change the quality of care.
Bringing that empathy lens is really so important. And it really does speak to the importance of the role of the family caregiver or the family friend, chosen friend and caregiver, the neighbor, the person who knows you best and the kind of supports that they can really provide along the journey. It's always sad for me, and I'm sure both of you have seen it as well, when someone has a dementia diagnosis, moves into a care environment, and the family stop visiting or friends stop visiting. And certainly we experienced some of that with my father, where some family friends felt that they couldn't cope, they couldn't manage it, they couldn't see that. My mother used to always say, how is it a choice? how is it a choice? There's still a human being here and a person. And there's such a value in that caregiver role. But I think the important thing is, how do you support those caregivers? Ontario has the Ontario Caregiver Organization is doing remarkable work now, and they started in 2017. I had a privilege of being part of that startup. And I think it's becoming more and more important as we think about access to services, but also with the demographic bump, this tsunami, which has arrived. The waves, it's quiet. If it's quiet, it's because the waves have receded, the water's receded, and it's hitting us. But how do we support one another and bring that empathy to the individual living with a dementia diagnosis, but also their family and friends around them to support them, to bring them along? So I love your energy. It really is more hopeful as we think about everything makes sense to them. So making sure that lands, I think that's such a great question. Sophia, I have a specific question for you. Just given the leadership of the work that you do, especially around working with seniors and medication management, this is a big issue in our long-term care and care settings. And we've spoken in this discussion about the fact that older individuals living with dementia are often living with multiple other diagnoses, and they're likely getting medication for those other diagnoses. So you have, I think the last time we looked and talked about it on this podcast, individuals moving into a long-term care home in Ontario, Canada, potentially 13 different medications at a minimum. And so those interactions, when you're thinking about the brain and the overlay of one medication offsetting or interacting with something else, how much of that is a factor in managing the symptoms of dementia versus perhaps balancing that with managing some of their other diagnoses?
Yeah, so this is such an important issue, I think, for many people living in long-term care, both who have dementia and otherwise. The rates of antipsychotic medications. So the antipsychotics are used often off-label to treat behavioral symptoms in dementia, and they're not even that effective. So I think another misconception, if I can go back to your previous question, is that many of this can be treated with medications, right? And then people layer medications on top of it. And then they then have side effects like loss of balance, falls, sedation. The rates of antipsychotics actually were going down pre-COVID because of a lot of efforts. And since COVID, the rates across Canada have started going up. And so they're going in the wrong direction. But what's also really concerning is the rates of other psychotropic medications like antidepressants have also started going up. And part of this is because people are replacing the antipsychotics with some of the sedating antidepressant medications. So about 70% of people living in long-term care are taking antidepressants. Yeah, so the number is pretty staggering, and this is available on CIHI. So it's like 68% and higher. Institute for Health Information. Yeah, so they publicly, they make this information available, and the rates of these medications in long-term care are much higher than the rates in the community. So this then we have to ask the question, why? Is it because people in long-term living in long-term care just have much higher rates of some of these challenges, and therefore they're appropriately treated? Or is some of the use of these medications potentially inappropriate in long-term care? And so some of the work that we are trying to do is being really mindful about, why is an individual on a specific medication? Is that actually benefiting them? And if it's not, then can we consider taking them off of that medication in a safe manner? And this really goes hand in hand with the person-centered approach that someone might say in the case that Adria just presented, that Well, we should put them on an antipsychotic so that they are more compliant with care. Like sometimes when you read notes, it's non-compliant with care. Start them on a medication, they're more compliant with care. But that had nothing to do with the reason this person was not sitting on the toilet, right? So when we, so I think these two efforts go hand in hand, that we are really mindful about why we are using a medication. And there are certain cases where we have to use them, especially if there is a risk of harm to themselves, if there's a risk of harm to staff or others that we are not able to solve using other ways, then there may be a use in some situations. But these rates are really not what we should be seeing.
Adria, in your world, you work with clinicians, you work with family members, you support, I would say, the dementia ecosystem in how everybody, whether you're a trained professional or a family member or somebody beginning on to live with dementia, are you seeing the medication element coming out at all?
Yeah, certainly working in long-term care communities, I would hear just instances like, oh, Bob needs to take a shower later. Let's give him his meds like an hour before so that he's easier to deal with, right? That's just the idea that when people feel uncomfortable, when they're having those behavioral expressions, especially during really intimate care tasks, that if it's too hard to figure out, or certainly like we haven't figured it out yet, then medication is just the go-to. And unfortunately, I think that's really common in the United States as well. So I certainly don't have the statistics there to tell you, but I'm sure that it's pretty similar to what Canada is experiencing. On a more like on a level to the community that I serve with my educational content, I do get messages pretty frequently from caregivers who are saying, here's a challenging situation that we're facing. What medications would you recommend? Or what medications do I need to ask for? My answer to that is always, I'm a speech language pathologist. I am not a pharmacist nor a doctor. That is not anything that I can recommend. But I recommend feeling out some non-pharmacological interventions that might be a more effective, because to Sophia's point, the data surrounding these medications are not even effective. They're not even doing the things that we think that they're doing. They're not always even necessarily making care easier. They're making people with dementia more prone to falls, more prone to being lethargic, decreased appetite, which then leads to weight loss, like all of these cascading things that actually are not solving any problems that we think that they are. I'm always encouraging people to first try these more creative, person-centered approaches because it's more effective in many cases. And also, that's certainly nothing I can give recommendations about anyways, but I do see that reflected in messages, and I get it, right? Like, especially when caregivers are at home, they're burnt out, they're struggling, perhaps even they feel like they are in danger or the person they're caring for is putting themselves in danger. And it really can be a scary situation. And it would be amazing if there is this magic pill that would make someone feel better. And also, it's important to acknowledge that when we're seeing behavioral expressions from someone with dementia, especially if they seem to be overly agitated and it's happening for a good amount of their day, we also don't want them to be in distress for that much time. So sometimes there are certainly times where medications are necessary, but I think that we just don't need to have the perspective that there is like a fix to everything, unfortunately.
I remember when my father was still living at home, he didn't want to take a shower. My mother and I sort of really thought about, okay, well, how can we support him? And he used to love going to the barber shop. So we took him to like an old-fashioned barber who washed his hair and shaved him and did his eyebrows and put a hot towel around his face. And I don't know if it was the nostalgia of it. I was the only woman in the barber shop with my dad, but it was a creative solution that was anchored in his past and his history, which suddenly we thought, oh, this actually worked. We're certainly seeing a lot of creativity in Ontario, Canada. Our current government and our current minister of long-term care is a big proponent of patient-focused care models, bringing new innovations into care, more holistic approaches to care. and our wait list, you're going to be horrified by this, Adria. The wait list just for long-term care in Ontario is, I think we're at 50,000 people at the time of our recording, which is December in 2025. 50,000 people waiting. And so part of what we're also seeing is the level of complexity of the care needs is escalating by virtue of the fact that people are waiting longer and more people are remaining in their homes longer because the access to care is not there. But I am curious, Adria. So one of our podcast friends is Katie Smith Sloan from The Leading Age, based out of Washington. And Katie has mentioned on earlier episodes in different seasons that in the United States, there is a trend of long-term care homes closing. So we're building more and rebuilding them. But there are parts of the United States where there is this migration away from the traditional long-term care model. Are you seeing that from your lens and your experience, given the breadth of your reach across the United States?
I've certainly seen instances of that. I think that what, from my experience, I see more long-term care communities being built, but typically they're more of the assisted living model. These are areas where we can be a little more creative and innovative because they're private pay. So in the United States, the only time that the government pays for long-term care is when someone is on Medicaid, which is different from state to state, but essentially you have to meet an income requirement. And for many people, that means spending down their life savings to a certain point to where they have next to nothing left, and then they can get long-term care paid for. And those care communities are the ones where I see them closing down, unfortunately. A lot of families do not want to choose to go that route and will instead, come hell or high water, will care for people at home. There certainly is a stigma around long-term care in general, and I think that's more reflected in that long-term care, like nursing home model of that being like, oh, I would never take my mom there. We hear those comments a lot. I'm from southeastern Kentucky in the Appalachian Mountains, a very rural area, and the stories from long ago of what nursing homes used to be are terrifying, to be quite honest. And it's not necessarily reflective of what nursing homes actually are now. We have certainly so many regulations and policies in place that have increased the quality of care, but there's that stigma still exists. And so there's a lot, especially in rural areas, of nursing homes closing down and people saying, I'm going to keep mama at home and do my best.
We're quite privileged in that long-term care in Ontario, in particular, all care provided in long-term care, regardless of governance, is publicly funded. And we are seeing more of a shift, though, where certainly seen just by virtue of the limitations of supply, more people living in retirement communities getting additional supports or people getting private care in their homes where they can afford it. But I know from my own family experience, we could care for my dad at home until we couldn't. And that happened really quickly. But he lived with dementia for 10 years before that was necessary. But I would agree, the long-term care, certainly in our province and in Canada today, isn't even the long-term care of 3 years ago. I don't know, Sophia, what your thoughts are on that, because I know you're leading a lot of research in this sector and part of a really great organization in the University, McMaster University, is doing a lot of work and research into long-term care, and it's evolving very quickly.
I would agree. And even in the time that I've practiced in long-term care, my perspective has changed. So I certainly have a lot of residents I see in long-term care who are happy to be in long-term care, who have found community, who have friends, who are more socially active and engaged than when they were living by themselves. And it's not something that I went in believing until I've had the opportunity to interact with them and see them in that environment. So I feel that going back to something that you mentioned where some folks would rather have made than go to long-term care, I would ask them to pause and maybe even visit a couple of homes because we make these assumptions based on stories that we hear. And these are not the stories that are reported about long-term care in the newspaper, right? When you hear about a long-term care in the newspaper, it's not good news. But the actual experiences of folks who live in long-term care may be quite different. I think it's great that there are a lot of regulations. But more than that, I would say I'm really impressed by long-term care home staff. It's hard work, and most of them come every day trying to do a good job to take care of individuals, right? And I think sometimes we think of hospital workers and, you know, we gave them a lot of support during COVID, but long-term care staff are working really hard. So I think the whole environment, yes, it's changing, it's evolving, and happy to talk more about some of the research stuff, but the clinical work there, people are working hard and I feel proud of the work that they do.
When you work in a long-term care home, you're not just caring for the individual, you're actually caring for their family. And I know my mother passed away 11 years after my father did, and she still kept in touch with the nurses and the PSWs who had cared for my father during that 11-year period after he had passed away. And because they had become part of her family, our extended family and friends. And I think we forget that. So in a hospital, someone may stay overnight, but in a long-term care home, someone may be living with us for years. And so that connection with family and supports, your role is so much more because you're caring for somebody in a home environment. It comes back to that person-centered approach. And I know that the moment someone walks in the door, the staff learn their stories. They want to know what their history is, what their stories were, what did they like to do, who were they, and that whole personal validation.
I think like the most amazing, compassionate, incredible people that I've ever met in my life have been under the roof of long-term care communities. I have spent my entire career there, and I also have a grandmother living with dementia. She's been in a nursing home for the last 5 years, and her function improved when she moved there. And what I mean by that is she had cognitive stimulation all day long. Her personality was such, she was nosy. Like she always has been, like sit at the window in the front of her house and like see all the cars going by and like, who's at Betty's house? And so to be in a care community, she had so many things to watch. She had so many stories to tell. And she was cognitively stimulated constantly. She was eating like 3 well-rounded meals. She was getting her medications on time. The routine and structure actually seemingly made her improve when she first got there. We were like, wow, like it almost made us question, like, should she have come here yet? But it was that structure that was so, and the stimulation that was so helpful for her. And when sometimes I'll get messages from caregivers at home or family, concerned family members typically is what it is, which is my sister is wanting to put my dad in a nursing home. And I'm telling her that she shouldn't do that. Like, do you have advice on how I can convince her otherwise? And I just want to say you've come to the wrong person if you're looking for someone to argue about going to long-term care, because I think that long-term care is great for so many people. And it's where I have developed all of my experience, all of my education, everything I know. I am a product of working in long-term care. So if you're here to argue about that, like I'm not the person to help. It's so beneficial and it's an amazing tool for so many families.
For those individuals who need it, it's so impactful and so powerful, and it really is changing and evolving. And we are learning from one another, from whether it's between Canada and the United States, with the United Kingdom, with Australia. We're all like the ideas that are being shared, the research that is being shared. I want us to end on one final question. If each of you could redesign dementia care from the ground up, what are the 3 areas you would focus on? So, Sophia, do you want to start? You get 3 wishes to redesign it.
So my first wish would be to co-design it with people with lived experience, their families, and with staff. Because often when we think of creating a new system, people might invite experts in research or people who have published a lot of papers, which is important. But I think people who live in that environment and people who work in that environment have to be really important partners of that work. And we've learned, so I work at the Research Institute for Aging at Waterloo, and one of their core values is really co-design with residents and staff. And we recently did a study on sleep in long-term care, and we worked with PSWs, night staff, residents who live in long-term care, and we learned so much about the long-term care environment at night, which maybe we don't see as folks who just go there to provide service during the day, right? And so we're trying to figure out how to improve sleep health in long-term care. And the residents tell us, well, we're not sleeping because every time someone needs care at night, they ring a bell and the alarm goes off to alert the nurse that everyone else can hear. And then everyone else is awake. But imagine in a unit where multiple people are ringing the nurse call bell multiple times at night. And people have actually recorded that overnight, there are like 7 times in an hour you can hear noises that's enough to wake up a regular person sleeping, right? So without talking to the staff and the residents, we would not have learned some of those things, which would be really important in how that environment is designed. So I think co-design is my first wish. The second is that in designing the system, as important as the environment is the design of the team, the model, the supports that we provide to the people who provide care. Long-term care is a highly regulated environment, and rightfully so. There are a lot of quality indicators, but without the right type of staff training and supports, it can come across as an added pressure to meet all of these regulations and boxes. So I think we really need to put in the system to support long-term care staff, because without good long-term care staff, there is no long-term care system, right? So that would be my second wish. My third maybe is biased a little bit because I'm a psychiatrist, and a lot of individuals with severe and persistent mental illnesses like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder are living in long-term care. And some of them have cognitive impairments of different kinds. And they can be younger than our average person with dementia. And sometimes they move there from group homes, which are not built for people with severe mental illness who are now aging and are not able to climb stairs. And that might be the reason they're now in long-term care. So they've lost their home, they've lost their community, and they've moved into a totally new environment. And sometimes our system doesn't have the right tools and supports to adequately understand and care for them. So increasing the mental health capacity to care for those individuals would be my third wish.
We talk a lot about the need for specialized psychiatric long-term care. So it's great to have you add that. It's an increasing issue. So Adria, your wish list.
Also, I'm a huge proponent of involving people with lived experience into the process of figuring out what they want, not asking experts what we think people with dementia want, but asking people with dementia what they want. But I think number one, and probably most important, the foundation of everything is education. It has become way more apparent to me through the process of having Be Light Care that education about what dementia is and how it presents in individuals living with it is a transformative part of the puzzle. So many times we like we talked about earlier, we can kind of take our frustration out on the behavioral expressions we see about dementia or what someone can't do or anymore, or the things that they are doing that's new that we don't like. And when we start having education, we understand that dementia is a neurological degenerative condition, that it causes these clinical symptoms. We start naming them. So instead of saying, well, they're in denial that they have dementia, if we name it that they maybe are experiencing anosognosia, that they do not have the capacity to understand that they have a condition, putting clinical terms to the things we're seeing separates the disease from the person. It allows us to have empathy for the person who's experiencing a disease rather than a condition, a diagnosis, rather than taking the frustration out on them. And so education, I think, across the board, whether you are someone at home caring for a person with dementia, you are a clinical staff in a care community, or you're just a regular person that lives on planet Earth, I think that education is really important for dementia care. The second I would say is to consider risk and independence as important as safety. So I think what we're doing in the United States with so many regulations and policies, it's really stifling the innovation that we can have in long-term care. And what I mean by that is in an effort to keep people with dementia and other aging individuals safe in care communities, we are really stripping away everything that it means to be a human. And I think that independence, having it, being as independent for as long as possible, is really important. And it's often how people have value and feel purpose within themselves. I've heard care communities that won't even allow their residents to help out with wiping off the tables or cleaning the windows because that is like, that's what employees do, and it would introduce risk to have them touch cleaning supplies when perhaps that's something that brings joy for a person to serve their community. And the same goes with risk, right? Like, we take a risk every time we go on a walk that we might trip over a crack in the sidewalk and fall, but that feels important to us. It might be a risk to have a body of water on your campus, but you know what? Sometimes people will sit and enjoy or like to fish there. So I think that in an effort to keep people safe, we remove all risk and independence, and that really is detrimental. And being in a litigious society, I understand why those things, those choices are often made, but thinking ahead in the future, that's not the kind of communities I want to live in, safe, sterile, boring places. And so I think we need to start reconsidering what that can look like. And I think the third thing that I would implement redesigning dementia care from the ground up is community visibility. I think seeing people with dementia is important because when people with dementia live in isolation behind closed doors, whether that is in a home or in a care community, then our imaginations as a society can run wild about what dementia looks like. And we then start to depend on what we see in media, whether that is fictional stories like The Notebook, or we see these like terrible news stories about things that are happening related to crime, or we just hear stories from the past. Dementia starts to become mysterious and dark and scary, and that is really detrimental and just adds to stigma. So I think community visibility, having communities in which if we see someone who seems disoriented, we know how to jump in and support them. We have places, restaurants, and spaces in our communities where caregivers and people with dementia feel comfortable going and don't have to be concerned. Unfortunately, here in Kentucky last year, an individual living with frontotemporal dementia, specifically the primary progressive variant, who had a difficult time communicating, was with his wife at a grocery store, and he went to check out without her. She had been talking to someone, and there was beer in the cart, and they asked for his identification, and he couldn't understand and was getting really confused. And they called the police on him. They thought that he was inebriated, intoxicated, tried to arrest him, which then confused him even further. And they end up body slamming him on the ground and taking him to jail. He was living with dementia and showing obvious signs of disorientation and confusion and difficulty with language. So as a community, that's not safe for a caregiver or for people living with dementia. And it's no wonder that they feel so isolated. So when it comes to dementia care, we need to see what dementia looks like, and we need to be more receptive to inviting them into our spaces.
Well, I think that's such a great note to end on. Sophia, you'll appreciate this. With being a psychiatrist, I spent about 20 years of my career literally taking down the walls of the asylum to normalize living with mental illness, and been talking about how do we normalize aging, how do we normalize dementia. As an association in Ontario, we actually have a long-term care community engagement day where homes across Ontario invite people in. But also we're trying to encourage? How do we support our residents in going out? And so how do we normalize it? And it's not so scary. If we can actually see people and identify people, have these discussions to educate people, because we know that so many people don't actually want to know about it. And yet when they finally are confronted with it, and it's the minority of people, not the majority, then they become even more fearful. So I really want to thank both of you for your leadership. It's very exciting to hear your stories and the work that you're doing and to support your work. Andrea, before we go, I do want to do one plug. So if you just want to tell us about your new app that's coming out, I'm really excited to be able to share that.
Yeah, in early 2026, the Dementia Care app will be available. And this is essentially an extension of what I've been doing, creating 90-second videos, 90 seconds or less, all about how to care for people with dementia and understand dementia better. So I have over 500 videos that are just readily accessible, and being on this app rather than the social media platforms they were on previously will allow caregivers or community members to just be able to type in whatever interests they have. So whether that's hydration or showering or even just understanding confusion a little bit better, you can type in exactly what you're looking for and find a slew of videos ready for you to perhaps inspire you about a technique that might work better than what you're doing right now. The whole purpose behind Be Light Care is to just shed light on the often dark and scary topic of dementia that it often feels like, to lighten the load for caregivers and also to light or spark an interest in others to learn more about dementia. So I'm excited about the app. It'll be ready soon that will hopefully do all of those things.
Well, we're very excited, and we'll be sure to put a link into the podcast posting when we go live. And Sophia, thank you for your work and your leadership with the Research Institute on Aging out of the University of Waterloo in Canada. Really exciting and really powerful work that's happening around innovation. The more we know, the sooner we can change the world. So, and please know that both of you are changing the world. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah.
This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Arjo. Arjo believes that empowering movement within healthcare environments is essential to quality care. With products and solutions that are designed to promote a safe and dignified experience through patient handling, medical beds, personal hygiene, disinfection, and the prevention of pressure injuries and venous thromboembolism, Arjo is committed to driving healthier outcomes for people facing mobility challenges. Learn more about Arjo solutions at www.arjo.ca.